Okay, here we go for the final session. The crazy person's way to find peace of mind. It's so important in these days to find some peace. And in our modern world, we have actually lots of resources, lots of money, able to come and go wherever we want. We live in big houses with hot and cold running water, air conditioning, good health. Oh, we can even watch movies in our house on the TV. So many wonderful things are happening today. But the one thing which we're missing is peace. You can have lots of wealth, lots of health, but if you haven't got peace of mind, what's the purpose? And so unless we have peace of mind, we are all crazy. And that's what we mean by being crazy. A crazy person is someone, what they see, what they hear, they misinterpret it, and they create problems where there should be no problems. Now, I was just telling this simile, one of my favorite similes, but there's people here for the first time, they may not have heard this one before. One of my favorite similes to show how crazy people are was the story of the two chicken farmers. I just told a story to a couple a few moments ago who have a lot of trouble in work with a difficult boss. And because they have trouble at work, they take all that stress and tension back home with them. Now that's being crazy. And to understand what I mean by this, we tell the story of the two chicken farmers. First chicken farmer goes into the shed where the chickens live early in the morning to collect the produce from the night before. So he takes his basket and walks into the shed and fills the basket up with chicken shit and leaves the eggs in the shed to rot. And he brings the shit into the house and stinks the whole house out. That's what we call crazy chicken farmer. Chicken farmer number two goes into the shed with the basket to collect the produce of the night before. He leaves the shit to rot and fills the basket with eggs. So he takes the eggs into the house, makes an omelette for his family, and sells the rest of the eggs in the market for cash. That's a clever, smart, wise, Buddhist chicken farmer. Now, the meaning of that simile is when you collect the produce of your day and take it home with you after work, what do you collect? What do you put in your basket and bring home? The shit or the eggs? Are you a shit collector or an egg collector? Now, I think most people, even if you put a little bit in the basket of the bad stuff, it stinks all the eggs, you can't eat them. Now, the moral of that story is, why is it that as human beings, what goes wrong in our day, in our week, in our life, is what we remember and collect and bring home into our present moment? Why do what happens, a bad thing which happened to us today, why do we keep that at the expense of all the beautiful, wonderful experiences you've had today, last week in your life so far? We do collect shit. No wonder we are sad, depressed, upset, angry. So really, we should just collect the beautiful experiences of our day, of our life, and leave the rest in the past to rot. That way, we become wise and not crazy. I know some people, when I first started talking like this, they said, aren't you supposed to remember the faults so you can learn from the mistakes of life? You ask any psychologist and they will confirm what the Buddha realized 2,500 years ago. You learn much more effectively, quicker and better by remembering what went right, by reflecting on the successes than you ever do by thinking about what went wrong. That works as well in business as it does in life. When people working in business, too often when something goes wrong, they start analyzing it, talking about it, remembering it. And what happens? Everybody gets dispirited. You want to blame someone. Negativity comes into the office and morale goes down. But if you remember on what went right, then everyone feels uplifted, they feel worthwhile, energy goes into the office, people feel high morale, they're energized, and also they tend to repeat the causes which made for that success. If you learn from the successes and forget the mistakes, you learn much more, more effectively and quicker. That works as well for business as it does for marriages, as it does for your life, as it does for meditation. So you leave the pain of the past behind and you learn from what went right. Now, why on earth can't we do that in, say, our marriages? Some people are married and they're as crazy as when they were kids. In other words, they always look at the faults in their partner, the faults in themselves, and they remember the mistakes. And eventually, if you keep filling up your mind with the shit of your marriage, of course, you know, it stinks so much, you can't stand it and you want to leave. This is what happens. Remember the things which went wrong. Now, why on earth don't we remember the things which went right? The happy times you've had together, the beautiful moments of your life together. The times when you were happy and why you were happy. If you keep remembering that, you will tend to get encouraged, inspired, and you will tend to repeat the causes of that happiness. So this is not being a shit collector, it's being an egg collector. That story was told by Ajahn Chah years and years and years ago. And that is positive psychology, which stops you being crazy. Because a crazy person is someone who has so much shit, if you like, please excuse me for using this word, so many problems and difficulties and negativity, it drives them insane. Have you ever noticed happiness drive anyone insane? Or positive feelings? It's always the pain, the difficulty, the hurt which drives you insane, never the happiness. Which is why that if you really are wise, you really want to learn about life, and you really want peace of mind, we have to develop that happiness. Which is why I mentioned this to someone during the break here, and it's a great little quote, because they were asking me about busy people and meditation. They said, well, look, you know, we have to find the time to meditate, and if you just allow people to meditate for 1 minute a day, they're never going to get anywhere. And actually my answer, which I should have really said during the talk, first of all you have to find meditation and then you find time afterwards. You don't find time first and then meditate. You find meditation first and then you find the time. What I mean by that is once you find meditation, you find the peace, the joy, the happiness, the ease of meditation, you like it so much, of course you find the time. People always find time for what they like. So you have to find meditation first. And then we find the time afterwards. Which what I mean by that, a minute of meditation, 2 minutes, whatever it is, to find the joy and the peace of meditation first, think, oh, this feels really nice. Then quite naturally the time will be found to extend the periods of meditation. You meditate more and more and more naturally because you enjoy it. That's certainly my life. First time I meditated was in the Wordsworth Room of King's College, Cambridge. I still remember it because it's one of the turning points of my life. In 1969, must have been about December, November. Remember the time and the place. Just sitting down, meditating for 5 minutes, never meditated before in my life. And it felt so peaceful. I remember afterwards saying, there's something really wonderful and beautiful in this. And of course, that was changed my whole life. So that's why I found meditation first, and then I found the time to be a monk. It's, what, 34 years now almost. So imagine how much time I found. So we find meditation, we find peace, we find happiness, and the time thing just happens naturally. People won't meditate because they don't know what meditation is yet. And that's why you say, I don't want to meditate, or I'm too busy to meditate, because you don't really know what it is. You find meditation first, the peace, the happiness, it feels so wonderful, so lovely. You can't help yourself but wanting to meditate more and more and more. Because that happiness is finding peace. A crazy person's way to find peace of mind. I've already mentioned a little bit about that crazy elephant, the crazy water buffalo. You don't find peace of mind by fighting the crazy mind, by trying to control the mad water buffalo. People try that. They think that you are stronger than your mind, that if you exert enough willpower, you can stop this mind. And of course, you can never do that. The crazy person is the ordinary person, and the only way to make peace with the crazy mind is saying, I allow my mind to be crazy. Come on, mind, you can be as crazy as you want to be. To understand this, one of the stories I tell, a personal story. I was a monk for six rains retreats as a monk, just 6 years. And after training, usually train in a monastery for 5 years, and then Ajahn Chah would actually send you off by yourself. We called it in Thailand going tudong. In Sri Lanka it's called charika, means just wandering. You are basically asked to leave your monastery, taking all your possessions with you, and you can wander wherever you wanted to go. You know, that was one of the most delightful periods of my monastic life, actually of my life. I finished 5 years of basic training as a monk, and now you could just go. And in Thailand, there were so many places you could stay. So even these days, being a monk or a nun is like having membership of Diners Club. You can go to any monastery, any center, and get food and a bed for the night. It's a wonderful club to join because we have offices all over the world. But especially in Thailand, if you didn't want to stay in a monastery, you could sleep out under the trees. You could go to any village in the morning on alms round, you'd always get something to eat. So I left with all my possessions on my back. Part of the rule was you could not keep anything with anybody. You couldn't keep it in the storeroom of the monastery, nor with any friends. You either had to give it away or take it with you. And so very quickly, actually the first day I hardly had anything to carry, but after a few days, even that got about reduced by 50%. Had my bowl, spare robes, a mosquito cloth, a flask for water. It was the most wonderful feeling of having all your possessions carried with you, and they were light, they weren't burdened down, and you could go wherever you wanted. When you came to any crossroads, you go left, right, straight ahead or backwards. You had no agenda, no place to be or get to. It was the most freedom I ever felt in my life. Nowhere to go, nothing to be, complete freedom like a bird, flying wherever I wanted. It was a wonderful time. Our possessions actually burden us. The more we have, the more crazy we are. The less we have, the more free we feel. That's what it was like in those days. No monastery to carry with me, no burdens, just my bowl and robes, just like a bird. You know, I've watched birds. I watched birds migrate from continent to continent, but never once have I seen a bird carrying a suitcase. They don't even have a bum bag with their money in it. In fact, that simile was so popular that there's a German edition of my book, The Mindfulness Bliss and Beyond, and that's actually a new edition. I just saw the brochure in the book catalogue, and they've called it The Bird Without a Suitcase. That's the title of a book in German by me. Because that's like freedom. So anyway, eventually when it got to our range retreat period, we're supposed to stay in one monastery and not wander around. It's our tradition, so that we can do more meditation in one place and stay put. So after wandering around, I found the perfect monastery. It was up in the mountains above Chiang Mai, maybe about 50, 60 kilometers away from Chiang Mai, way up in the mountains. And it was a lovely valley, and in the valley you couldn't see any houses. The village, maybe six houses, was over the hill. So whatever they did, whatever noise, you would not hear them. And as for traffic, you would see only one car would come up each week to bring up the mail and to take out some produce, some pomelos, back down to the town down below. You'd have to be watching at a particular time of the day, one day a week, to see the traffic, which is one car a week. So it's a perfect monastery. And I was alone there, nothing to do, very easy to look after. And oh, I was just having such a wonderful time for the first couple of weeks. But then my mind started to get restless. I started thinking. And the more I tried to stop my mind, the more it started to think. The problem was the type of thinking which was going on in my mind. I call them these days unmonkish thoughts. And I think you understand what that means. It's thoughts of old girlfriends, thought of sex, romance. Now, I was 6 years as a monk at this time, and I really wanted to be a monk. I didn't want these thoughts. I liked being a monk, but they kept on coming into my mind. And the more I tried to stop them, the more they came in. And the worst thing about this experience was I had no one to talk to. I was alone in this monastery for 3 months. I remember on this one occasion, my mind went so crazy thinking about all sorts of deviant thoughts, thoughts of things a monk should never think about. And I was so crazy, so desperate, I went into the main hall and bowed to the Buddha and said, "Help." And I don't know why, that inspiration came up. Maybe because I was a Westerner, I say, "Let's do a deal." And the deal was this. The deal was, I'd watch my breath for most of the day, but if my mind really wanted to think about girls, I'd give myself from 3 p.m. till 4 p.m. every afternoon, and you can think whatever you want then. Sounded fair enough to me. If my mind wanted to follow those fantasies, I'd allow myself 1 hour every day, 3 to 4 p.m. The rest of the time you behave. That was the deal. So I went back to meditate, and it was as bad as ever. All these thoughts come in and say, "Get out, I want to be a monk, watch the breath," and the picture of an old girlfriend would come up, "Shut up." And it was so tiring and so frustrating having a mind like that. But when it came to 3 p.m., I had to keep the other side of the bargain. So I went up to my hut. I was so tired. I leaned against the wall and put my feet out and said, "Okay, mind, you want to think about anything, anything under the sun, anything goes." And for the next hour, my mind watched every breath without any problem whatsoever. It was crazy. I couldn't understand what was going on, but now I understand perfectly what was going on. When I tried to control my crazy mind, it got worse, much worse. And that's why I was fighting so much, you know, being ashamed of having these thoughts. I was trying so much to stop them. I realized that was what was feeding them. When I let go, the magic word, "Okay, whatever you want to think is fine by me," the mind watched every moment of every breath. It was amazing just how easy it was. And I learned a very, very valuable lesson there. I understand where the crazy mind comes from being controlling, wanting, and too much will. That's where you go crazy. And I've noticed that the people who are the biggest control freaks, they go through this progress, this procession of states. They want to get control. Maybe they become managers and your manager. And eventually, when you want to control, sometimes it just doesn't go the way it should do. You get frustrated. All control leads to frustration because you find that you do not have power. The world works according to its natural causes. You can't control the world. You can't even control yourself. How can you control other people or control nature? When you have will, strong will, you soon get frustrated. Frustration then leads to anger, where you sort of blow up and shout at other people out of desperation. And after anger, you know what the next stage is? Depression. You just give up. What's the point? And I've seen that the reason why that many people are depressed these days is because they're control freaks. We control so much, we think we have so much power, that where we get through frustration, anger, after anger, depression comes next. It's a crazy way of dealing with things. And depression makes you crazy. The alternative is letting go a bit more, flowing along with things, not sort of controlling things so much. This is the way life is. This is the way husbands are. This is the way wives are. One of my favorite stories about the craziness of human beings and the solution to that craziness is the story of the two Thai sisters. These two sisters came to me for counseling. They were sisters. They were very good supporters of our monastery. So they made an appointment and I saw them. And Asian tradition, I asked the elder sister first of all, what's your problem? Her problem was her husband. She was having a lot of difficulty getting on with her Western husband, maybe some cultural problems, having arguments, and she was really thinking that it was the time to separate. But you know, usually as a Buddhist, I try and keep people together because I think that if they can work through those problems, once they're on the other side of those problems, they become wonderful human beings. If they can, it's really worthwhile putting forth the effort. So I was given her all these skillful means, all this advice on how she could keep together with her partner. But in the end, she was still on the edge, should I, shouldn't I? Her problem was with her husband. And then I turned to her sister, her younger sister, what's your problem? And she said, well, you know, I've had many boyfriends, but they only last about a month. And I can't tend to keep any boyfriends. I really want a long-term relationship. And I'm getting old now. I want someone to share my life with. I want someone to love and someone who loves me. I want a husband. When she said that, I thought of a solution. I said, your sister's got a husband she doesn't want. And you want one. Why don't you swap? I was really surprised they wouldn't have a bar of that. They're sisters anyway. Don't you love each other enough to share? And that made them laugh, but then I told them the deeper meaning. I turned to the elder sister who had a husband and said, madam, you have got what we call in Buddhism husband dukkha, husband suffering. Because all you girls will know that. If you have a husband, sometimes it's really difficult. And that's called husband suffering. It's a certain type of dukkha which you'll only know if you've got a husband. And I said, your sister has got what we call single woman suffering. You know, when you're looking for a partner, when you're alone, you get a lot of freedom being alone, but there's something which is missing. That's that sort of missing that I want someone to share my life with. That's called single woman suffering. And I said, look, to the elder sister, if you get rid of your husband, you separate, you will not have husband suffering anymore. Husband dukkha will be finished. You'll have what your sister has. Single woman suffering. And you single woman, if you find a husband, that type of pain and suffering which you don't like of being single and being alone, that will disappear. And you'll have your sister's dukkha. You'll have married people suffering. And that's the same with young men. They're looking for a partner in life. As a young man without a partner, you have young man suffering. But when you get married, you have married man suffering. And some of you want children. You have sort of no children suffering. You think, oh, wouldn't it be nice to have you have this feeling, this urge, you want to have a child. Once you have a child, you won't have that suffering of having no offspring. You'll have having children suffering. Oh, I've got to wake up in the morning. I've got to worry about this. I've got no time for myself. So what happens next is that some people, they don't want a husband, they don't want a wife, they don't want kids because they know all that suffering. So they renounce and become monks or nuns. And it's true, once you become a monk or nun, you don't have husband suffering, you don't have wife suffering, you don't have kids suffering, you have monk suffering. It's true. So the point is, when we understand Dhamma, we understand by changing the situation, by changing your wife and getting a new one, or changing your husband and getting a newer model, trading the old one in for something better, or by changing your job, or changing your marital status, or changing whether you're a layman or a monk. When I was a young monk, when I was like a baby monk, I used to look up the head of the line and see all these abbots. And I think, wow, they get the best food. Just like me, you know, people feed me the delicious food. Like the young little novices, they got what's left over. And I used to think as a young monk, because food was really difficult over in Thailand, and by the time it got to the monks like me, there was only just the gravy left, and all the other vegetables and best rice had all gone. And I thought, you know, this is really unfair. Because when you look up the top of the line, all the old monks, they're the fat ones, like this one. All those senior monks, they don't need food. It's those small, skinny ones. We're the ones who need them. And not only that, all the novices, we had to sit on the hard concrete. And all the senior monks, the big abbots, they had all the fat seats, you know, the big cushions. I said, what do they want a big cushion for? They've got natural upholstery. We're the ones who should have the big cushions. We're full of bones. And those senior monks, those abbots, they decide all the work projects. They decide to build the hall or to, you know, to build a road. And we're the ones who have to do the work. It's all right for them sitting down talking to people all day, having fun, and going off to Kuala Lumpur and PJ and Kuching, teaching the Dhamma. That's a wonderful life, but we have to stay at home and work. It's really unfair. I had what's called young monk suffering. Now I'm an old fat monk. I look at those young monks. Oh, those young monks have such an easy time. They don't have to answer all these problems which people have. People come up to me and say, oh, my husband is playing around. And so I give them some advice. And another lady comes up and say, oh, my husband is playing around. And I say, give her some advice. And the next woman comes up, oh, my husband is... All the same problems. I think, why me? Why do I have to answer all those problems? As I said, I think the other day, I became a monk so I didn't have to worry about marriage. And what would I know about marriage anyway? Never been married, I've been a monk. So I call that abbot suffering. So in the end, sometimes, you know, the monks ask me, said, how can you do all this, traveling around, talking to people all day, signing all these books? Don't you ever get fed up signing all these books? And I said, I could get fed up if I wasn't wise enough. That's, you know, author suffering. But I realized that you accept this, you make peace with it, you let it be. Doesn't matter what you have to do in life, whether it's traveling, suffering. Oh, I remember telling this story in Singapore. Now, I'd been doing, this was last year, or was it year before now? I did a Dharma teaching tour of Europe and North America. It was so tiring, going from place to place, giving talks and stuff. And I was on my way back and flying from LA, you know, via Singapore. And it's a long flight, and I was really tired, and I'd been working so hard. But I've got many sort of disciples, you know, working SIA, Singapore Airlines. And so they were waiting for me at the gate to take me into the lounge and get some breakfast because I arrived early. It's very kind of them actually to meet me and give me a breakfast. But as soon as they took me into the lounge, they didn't just give me a breakfast. Can I ask a question, please? And I thought, okay. So I never get a free meal as a monk. No such thing as a free lunch for an abbot. They're asking all these questions, but I'm getting so tired because always they're asking, can I ask one more question? It's always one more question. And then another one more question. I'm getting so tired. I really was tired. So I thought, how can I get out of this? And I thought, I had an idea. Go to toilet. At least I could sit down and be quiet. But you know what happened? True story. I went into the toilet of the lounge at Changi Airport. And as soon as I walked in, the toilet attendant recognized me. Ajahn Brahm, can I ask a question? And even the toilet attendant kept asking me questions. And I realized there's no escape. No escape. So if I wanted to, I could very easily go crazy. But I don't go crazy. Just allow things to be. It's my karma. So I must have asked heaps and heaps of questions of some arahat in a past life and gave him headache, and now I have to pay for it. Payback, yes. But I enjoy it and have fun. So whatever you have to do, if you get negative about it, complain about it, get angry about it, that's called controlling. That leads to frustration. Frustration leads to anger. Anger leads to depression. You go crazy that way. So why fight when you can't sort of do anything about it? Instead, I just put fun and happiness to whatever I have to do in life. And that's why you don't go crazy. If you have a crazy lifestyle, you know, what people think is a mad lifestyle, going around all the place and doing all these strange and weird and wonderful things. But, you know, I really enjoy it because, you know, I just, the other day, opened an art exhibition. And, you know, the art exhibition was for impermanence. What is it called? Impermanence and Change or something in Perth. Go on the radio, go on TV. I do all sorts of weird things. One of the weirdest things I ever did was I went on this live radio show because I had some disciples who working in a big radio station in Perth. And they said, well, you know, why didn't you come along and do sort of a talkback show one evening? And I said, oh, sure, I'm into that. So I turned up one night because I'm very busy. The only time I could come was from 10 till midnight. And so after I gave a talk, I don't mind doing interesting things. You know, so I went over there. But I was very heedless. My mistake was I never asked what the program was. So when I went to the radio station, I was actually ushered into the studio because I only got there just in time. I had the headphones on, the microphone was in front of me. We had about 1 minute before we went live. And the MC or whatever, the person who's running the radio show, introduced me to my co-host. There's a lady called Dr. Gabriel Morrissey. And said, what's your speciality? And she said she was a sexologist. I thought, oh my goodness. What have I got myself into? What type of show is this? And the person running the show said it's on adult themes. It was an adult show where people, the general public, were ringing in to get advice on their, you know, their personal problems. And there I was, a Buddhist monk, celibate for over 30 years. And people were ringing up. It's a silly situation I get myself into, but once you're inside the studio, you can't go anywhere. You're stuck there. So I made the best of it. And so I had great fun telling people about their private lives. And no amazing thing. That's actually where, because I was, you know, how do we pronounce your name? Ajahn Brahm. Always remember there's an M on the end. Otherwise, it sounds like ladies' underwear. They could not pronounce it. So in the end, we decided Mr. Monk. That became our name. So all these people were ringing up. It's live, you know, live sort of live to air. They're ringing up on the telephone. and asking all these personal problems. And what I was really surprised at, they were all asking, they could either talk to the expert, Dr. Morrissey, who's well known in Australia, apparently. She writes books on personal problems. You know, she's a professor at some university, of professor of psychology on sex, basically, and, you know, how to do it, and I don't know what else. And after about 5 minutes, all these callers, they were directing their questions to me. Here's a question for Mr. Monk. And this expert there was doing absolutely nothing, getting bored. Well, all the questions were coming to me. It's amazing. Even if you haven't had sex for over 35 years, you become the expert. And you know why? Because you don't know the actual app. You know where things go. You know emotions. You know the way of the mind. And that's why people are just so interested in, like, the monk's perspective on these things. You know, it's all about sort of, you know, fear and just going above fear, relaxing, letting go, you know, all these things. You know, I don't know why I say these things, but once you know how the mind works, you know how everything works. You know, once I was at another conference, and this was a conference on transport, because the local government and the state government of West Australia, they wanted to know about the way forward with, like, transport policies. We have more trucks, bigger roads, or more rail transport. And they wanted members of the general public, because I knew a few of the politicians, they said, why don't you come along, get the Buddhist perspective on transport. And so I'd never done that before, so okay, I'm in. So the minister invited me over there, so I went to this conference, and they were talking about trucks and stuff like that. But in the interval, one of the journalists, you know, because I stood out, I don't know why I stood out, the journalist interviewed me. And it was a journalist for, like, a shipping paper. And they interviewed me about, you know, my views about shipping and rail and transport. And look, I don't know anything about that business. But, you know, I gave my sort of answers. And I saw him about 6 months later. I completely forgot about that interview, but he actually told me. He said, Ajahn Brahm, you know, I wrote that article. I called it, you know, Zen and the Art of Shipping. And he said, you wouldn't believe it, he told me. I didn't believe it, but he said it was absolutely true. That article was syndicated to all the major shipping papers and magazines of the world. And he said he got heaps of feedback. And the feedback he got regularly from many people was, we don't know who Ajahn Brahm is, but that monk certainly knows what he's talking about. And I didn't know anything what I was talking about. I was just making it up as I went along. But when you're in that situation, you just let go and allow it to be. And it's amazing what you can do when you just make peace. You don't fight, you don't control, you just enjoy all these amazing silly things which happen to you in life. And then you don't go crazy. So the purpose of crazy is just you enjoy it, whatever life gives you. You make peace with it. And life is so interesting. Sometimes people say, don't you get bored being a monk? Wow, I don't get bored being a monk. I do all sorts of interesting things. One of the other interesting things I did a couple of years ago, which was fascinating, because Queen Elizabeth II, she was visiting Australia for Commonwealth Games. Now, Malaysia was obviously in the Commonwealth Games. That was in Melbourne in, was it 2006 or 7 or 4 or 5 or what, I don't know. I live too much in the present moment. That's why sometimes I'm late for my aircraft. But because she came over to Australia, they wanted a bit of a religious theme to just beforehand. So I got invited, first of all, to Sydney to speak at an interfaith conference in front of Queen Elizabeth. And one thing I actually found out about her, because I was sitting right in the front, and there she was. No, I was sitting opposite to her, because we were just in front, and she was sitting in the front row with Prince Philip and who else was there? I think Prince Edward or someone. The three of them were there. And during the sermon, because most of the service was done by the Anglicans, the Queen was wearing a big hat. And I found out why Queen Elizabeth always wears big hats. No, because she had her head down during the sermon. She fell asleep. It's true. She did. Because I was watching her and I could see her nod up, you know, just as if you'd just woken up. And the reason he has a big hat because you can't see her eyes close. So the TV cameras can't catch her when she's taking 40 winks. So later on, so you met her, and the most interesting thing was there were three appointments, and the third one was a state dinner. It was a state dinner in Parliament House in Canberra. And I was invited there, and I was so pleased because there was the head Anglican priest of Australia, but the head Anglican and myself, we were the only religious people there. I don't know actually how I got in, but it was actually quite difficult getting in because I received the invitation, no, from the Prime Minister, John Howard, and on the invitation was the dress code. This was a state dinner. And I looked down the list, there were three options. Tuxedo. Not one person in my monastery had I couldn't borrow it from anybody. So what else we've got? Next one on the list was military uniform with medals. No, it's not military uniform. But I looked at the third choice. It was long dress. I was in. So I went under long dress. And it's great fun because I said all these important people like Lachlan Murdoch was there, you know, huge rich people and all these powerful generals and ambassadors and politicians. So when I went in there, I was stopped by security. I said, are you supposed to be here? And I thought she had my invitation. See, it's here, that's me, I can go in. So they let me in. I had great fun in there because I was the only Buddhist monk in there, and you know, you could have good fun. Of course, I didn't have any dinner. But actually, what I did have, this is actually what a monk eats when you have dinner with the Queen of England. First plate, they had some fish course, because it has to be like Australian, had Australian fish. And for me, I had Australian cheddar. A whole plate of cheddar. And you know, this was we can eat cheese in the afternoon as monks, but this was the most delicious cheese I'd ever tasted. Because, you know, when you have dinner with the Queen, they don't do their shopping in Safeways or Woolworths or the local supermarket. Now, this is really best. And I was really getting into it. I must admit, I got attached to it because I was talking to the person. Then the waiter or the butler or whatever took it away. And I said, hang on. And the waiter told me, look, there's another plate coming next. And so the next plate was, I think they had some lamb, you know, some sheep, you know, which is very Australian. And for me, had a plate of Australian camembert. Well, and that was really delicious, but this time I made sure I ate most of it before they took it away. And the last course was the best. Everyone else had macadamia pie. Because macadamia nuts from Australia. And for me, they gave me a chocolate dish, dark chocolate. And it was beautifully arranged. It was actually made into like a vase of flowers. And I should have actually taken a picture of it because it was the most amazing concoction I'd ever seen. They've really put some effort into making it interesting. I passed it around to all the other ambassadors and they really enjoyed it as well as I did, but it looked much better. So I have great fun as a monk. It's not boring at all. I mean, how many of you can have a three-course meal of chocolate and cheese with the Queen of England? But next week I was busy mixing concrete with the other monks. Getting dirty. I remember once actually I was mixing concrete in the early days. I still know Abbott, and I was busy mixing concrete for one of the buildings over there. I worked really hard still. And as I was mixing concrete, that we finished just before lunch, and so I was walking back to my room to take a shower before we had our dana, and I met this Sri Lankan lady. She was really dressed in expensive sari, makeup, you know, looking very nice. She'd come to the monastery for the first visit. And so she passed me and she said, excuse me, now where's the abbot? And I thought very quickly. And I said, if you go up to the room over there, the main hall, he'd probably be there in about 10 or 15 minutes. I never told her who the abbot was, obviously. because I was really messy. I was, you know, just been mixing concrete all morning, just, you know, full of dirt and really scruffy. So I went to my room and I quickly washed and changed my clothes into my robe and then went to meet her. And, you know, I told her some nice Dharma stories about meditation. She was really impressed. And just before she left, she said, "Look, I'm very impressed with your teachings in your monastery. This is what Buddhism should be. A real good monastery where monks are practicing well. But if you don't mind me saying one thing, I met one of your monks up there and he was very badly dressed. And I say, 'Madam, I'll talk to him about it later.'" I never got angry with her or sort of said, explain what was happening. And when you have fun, how can you get crazy when you have fun? So I think all these stories I've told so far, you understand that when you don't get angry and don't get crazy and have put fun into life, you find peace, satisfaction, contentment. So happiness is one of the most important causes for contentment and for peace, which is why that as Buddhists, please be happy Buddhists. Don't go around being strict and a pain in the neck to all your friends, converting them, or being sort of dogmatic. The purpose of these teachings is to bring peace to yourself and peace to others. And the sign of peace is a happy heart, a playful heart. Saw that in an article about happiness written by some, it was actually the psychologist who's running the Cambridge Institute of Wellbeing, a professor. It's one of the departments in Cambridge. And she said, a sign of a peaceful person is they're happy and playful. Which is, I'm a playful monk. Still am. You know, crack jokes and mess around. Because that is a path of peacefulness and happiness. It encourages, inspires, and gets rid of the idea of like controlling. You let go, enjoy the moment, make peace with it. So instead of fighting, we make peace. There is a time to put effort into one's life. We know how to do that. We've been trained in our schools, in our universities, to work hard. What Buddhism adds is how to rest and make peace. And when there's nothing you can do, how to sit still and just relax. It's amazing just the different techniques which we have to find peace instead of getting crazy. And you find if you get angry and get crazy, you always end up on the wrong side of the interchange. You know how to make peace. It's amazing just how things can turn out to your advantage. One of the stories, I'm not sure when I last told this story. Well, I told this story actually to the president of Sri Lanka when I saw him just over a year ago. Had breakfast with him. And interestingly, you know, this was a president, Mr. Rajapaksa. He's not just a constitutional president, he's the boss. He's the one who makes all the decisions, the head politician of the whole island. And he's obviously very concerned about the problem with the Tamil Tigers in the north and east of the country. One interesting thing I found that when I had breakfast with the president in the palace, he gave me baked beans. That's what you do in palaces. You have baked beans for breakfast. He'd obviously done his research. But I told him this story because he was having a very difficult time with the press, like many politicians do. You make a tiny mistake and all the newspapers are on your back. And I know many of these politicians, they have such a difficult time because a lot of occasions the press, even though they're trying to do the best thing, they emphasize the negative because that's get the circulation up. So the president was having such a difficult time. So I wanted to tell him the story of the donkey who fell in the well. I also actually told a story to Mr. Khaw Boon Wan. He was the health minister in Singapore during the time of the NKF problem, the National Kidney Foundation, which was seen as actually embezzling a lot of funds. That was the accusation. And Mr. Khaw Boon Wan, he's the health minister, they were said that he was negligent. He wasn't really watching this organization while he was on the job. So he got bad press as well. I told a story to him as well, and he appreciated it so much. He's now the patron of our Buddhist fellowship in Singapore. Anyway, the story was this. So one day, a donkey, an old donkey, was wandering through the forest. And as he was wandering through the forest, quite heedlessly, he never noticed a big hole in the ground until he fell in it. He fell down a disused well. Fortunately for the old donkey, by the time he got to the bottom, he hadn't broken any bones. A bit bruised, a bit scratched, but otherwise quite okay. But then he looked up, and the well was quite deep. It was a long way to the top, and donkeys can't climb. So there was Donkey in the bottom of the well, with no way out. So he did the only thing which Donkey could do. He started shouting, "Ah, ah, ah." Now, I can't really do donkey sound, so that has to be good enough for you. "Ah, ah, ah." He started crying. Minute after minute, hour after hour, "Ah, ah, ah." And eventually, a farmer heard a sound. "And what's that sound? What's it? It's coming from the well. That's really interesting." And so he went to the well, looked down, and saw an old donkey has fallen in the well. And that was a very cruel farmer. He never liked that old donkey. So he said, "Serve you right, falling into the well. Should be more mindful." But he thought, you know, that's a dangerous well. Now, other people might fall into that. So, you know, I always meant to fill it in. Why don't I fill it in now with the donkey on the bottom? That way I can get rid of this donkey and also fill in the well. Ha, ha, ha. He was a very cruel farmer. So he got a spade and started digging earth and throwing the spadeful of earth into the well. And all this dirt started falling over Donkey. And he kept on going, "Ah, ah, ah." And every spadeful of earth, it just started covering the donkey. And when its legs were almost covered, it realized what was going on. That cruel farmer was burying him alive. "Ah, ah, ah!" "Even louder," said the donkey. But did that stop the farmer? He just got more into shoveling. He was going to kill this donkey and fill up the well. "Ah, ah, ah!" said the donkey. And then suddenly the donkey went quiet. Farmer thought, "Aha, I buried him already. Serve him right." But that's not what happened. The reason why the donkey got quiet, because he had what we call in Buddhism, insight. He saw the Dhamma. What Donkey saw was, this was a problem, but no need to get angry. "Turn it to my advantage," said Donkey. So the next shovelful of earth, which fell on the donkey's back, he never complained. He just shook it off, stamped it under his feet, and noticed he grew a centimetre higher. Another shovelful of earth, shake it off, stamp it in, another centimetre higher, but without making any sound. And the farmer thought he'd killed the donkey, but he hadn't. The donkey was getting higher and higher and higher. Another shovelful of earth, shake it off, stamp it in, another centimetre higher. And the farmer was so busy shoveling the earth, he never noticed a pair of ears appear on top of the well. And then a head appear on top of the well. And then a body. And the donkey was soon high enough he could jump out of the well. And before he ran off, he bit the farmer on the backside to teach him a lesson and said, thanking him for saving him from the well. And the moral of that story, especially to politicians or to people in government like Victor, if you make a mistake and the press shovels dirt all over you, just shake it off, stamp it in, and you're a centimetre higher. Or if your boss at work starts shouting at you, shake it off, stamp it in, and you're a centimetre higher. But no need to complain and get angry. That's a very wise donkey. Now, surely you can be wiser than donkeys. Maybe. Maybe not. But that's how you use Dhamma. Instead of getting crazy and upset, make use of it for your advantage. So when you make peace with the difficulties of life, instead of getting crazy, it's amazing, because a donkey was peaceful, not making any noise, and knowing by being peaceful and being wise, stamping in the dirt, was getting closer and closer and closer to escape. So peace is the way to freedom. If you get crazy and we control and do too much and fight battles we can't fight, can't win, we just make life much, much, much worse. So which is why, for crazy people's guide to peace, allow your craziness to be. Make peace with it. And then you find, no matter what you have to do in your life, like me as a monk, amazing stupid things which I have to do, but I enjoy every moment of it, because I make peace with it, and I can exploit it. Every time anything strange happens to me, I can always use it as material, for my talks. Thank you very much. You know, one of the most dangerous experiences which ever happened to me, I was so glad there wasn't a person with a camera. Because when I used to go to the south of Perth, there's a town called Bunbury. And I used to go down there to the prison to teach. But because of difficulty with transport, I'd go there just after a quick lunch at the monastery and have to wait in the afternoon, because I could only go to the prison to teach in the evening. And it was actually the Catholic priests in the city, they gave me accommodation for the night. I always said I was a mole, a Buddhist mole in the Catholic headquarters. No, it wasn't really. I had good fun with them. But one afternoon, I had all afternoon free. I had a beautiful beach and it was deserted. So I thought I'd go and have a walk on the beach and have a meditate. So I was, we'll have a nice walk and sat on the beach, closed my eyes and meditated for about an hour. And when I opened my eyes, I got terrified. Because I looked to my left and there's this beautiful 18-year-old girl in a bikini, a nice blonde, sitting right next to me. And on the other side was a beautiful brunette, also in a skimpy bikini. If anyone had taken a photograph at that time, I would not have been able to explain it. So what do you want? What do you want? And you know what happened? It was a local high school. That day was the last day of their examinations. For the end of the school year, they were doing examinations, which would mean they go to university. And of course, after finishing their last exam of their whole school time, now being sort of Australian next to the beach, to celebrate, they'd changed into their bikinis, into their bathers, and gone down to the beach to celebrate. And they'd seen this monk sitting so peacefully, and these two girls were so fascinated, they sat down to wait for me to come out of meditation so they could ask about, you know, what were you doing? That was really cool, you know, meditating. So they had the best intentions there, and I just talked about meditation, gave them a few instructions, and I asked questions about Buddhism. And then I got out as soon as I could. Because what would it look like? There is Ajahn Brahm with two bimbos on either arm. So you have some wonderful experiences as a life as a monk in the West or in Singapore, Malaysia. But you don't get crazy about it. You don't get upset about it. You know, once I've been in a pub in Australia. You know what happened? It was a Rotary Club. The Rotary Club wanted to talk about Buddhism. So usually they use a pub. It's usually the back rooms of a pub. And so you don't have to go through the bar, you can just actually go to the back rooms of the pub and just give the talk and go out afterwards. But this particular pub, it was in the country, and I got to the entrance, how do you get to the room at the back where the Rotary Club meet? So there's only one way through the bar. So, oh my goodness, I can't go in a bar. So that's the only way. I thought, what should I do? So I thought to myself, I could see it, you know, maybe about 50 meters down the hall, I could see the room. I was like, okay, head down, run for it. So that's what I did. I put my head down and just made a beeline as fast as I could walk without drawing attention to myself. for the door, and I got about halfway when somebody grabbed me by the arm, and they were the Rotarian. "Hey, you're the speaker tonight. What are you having to drink?" I said, "Leave me alone. I'll take an orange juice, but in there." So I had to run away quickly. But in all of those encounters, you have really good fun because you don't allow yourself to go crazy. In the situations which present themselves to you in life, difficult situations, situations which shouldn't happen, embarrassing situations, or even painful situations, remember, you can always make peace with anything in life, even pain and difficulties. Making peace means you allow it to be, you enjoy it, see the funny side of it, and you can turn it to your advantage no matter what it ever is. And that way you find you never go crazy. Crazy is fighting battles you just cannot win. Life is very fascinating and interesting. If you want to change it and make it different, that sends you crazy. Instead of appreciating the way your karma works out, make peace with it. And that's the best thing you can possibly do. And life becomes fascinating, full of learning experiences. You grow, and as you grow, it becomes happier and more interesting. So that's some stories. Hopefully some funny stories. The crazy person's guide to peace of mind. And it was a crazy afternoon with some crazy stories. But I hope you got peace of mind. I did anyway. So thank you for that. But I hope you got peace of mind. I did anyway. So thank you for that. Now, any questions or comments? Yeah.
Oh, it's a very amusing stories there, but what about situations whereby there are more serious consequences, say like relatives, they're sick, child is sick, and the other type of challenges?
Okay, even the so-called painful experiences, relatives sick, child is sick. I remember a Tibetan nun, she was Western, joined the Tibetan order. She was sick with cancer, dying, and I counseled her for a while. And then one day I was working in my monastery down in south of Perth. I got a telephone call from her, and she said, "Look, I feel I'm going to die soon. Can you come and visit me?" I said, "I'm busy. Today, I think it's tomorrow I'm going to die." She was perfectly accurate. The next day she passed away. So I dropped everything I was doing, got one of the drivers to stop what they're doing and drive me in about an hour and a half to the hospice. When I got to the hospice, you just can't walk into the ward, to the rooms of these people who are just so sick, they're next to death. You have to check in with the head nurse first of all. So I went to the counter and I said, "I've just come to see this Tibetan nun." And she said, "I'm terribly sorry, but this nun is not seeing anybody. She's too sick." And I said, "Look, I've just come for an hour and a half to see her." She said, "Look, we must respect our patients' wishes." She was really firm with me. But I said, "Look, she just phoned me up an hour and a half ago. She asked me to come." And this nurse scowled at me, said, "Come here." So I followed her. And we went to the door of her room. She said, "Look." And sure enough, on her door was a big sign, "Absolutely no visitors." And the nurse said, "See?" And I looked, and actually underneath in small print was, "Except Ajahn Brahm." And you know what I did? I told that nurse, "See?" It was pretty mean, I must admit, but I wanted to get my own back. So she scowled and let me in. But the reason I tell that story was I asked the nun, "Why did you put that sign up there? And why did you say, except Ajahn Brahm?" And she said, "Because every other visitor who comes in here gets so serious and gets so emotional about my dying. I know I'm dying. I don't need to be asked by my friends, 'How are you today?' I'm sick, I'm dying, stupid. What do you expect? I'm in a hospice." She said, "You're the only one who comes in here and treats me as a human being, who tells me jokes and talks to me and not talks to my sickness." And I heard that and I understood something very important. When a person is sick and dying, never talk to the sickness, talk to the person. As you would talk to them if they're fully healthy, that's how you should talk to them when they're sick. Sickness is only part of the person, and a small part. Even when they're dying, it's only their body dying, not the person. And what if you are ever sick and you get visited by your friends and relations, it gets really boring and disappointing when people keep asking you the same question, how are you today? And so often you have psychological pressure to lie, to say I'm feeling a little bit better today, just to cheer up the people who love you, when really you're feeling terrible. Because what's it like if someone visits you and you tell the truth, I'm feeling awful today? It's not a very nice gift to people who have come all that way to see you. So that's why it's good to talk to the person, not to the sickness. Which is why if a person is really sick, sometimes you see deeper than their sickness. If they're dying, see deeper than their death. It's only the body dying. This is deeper ways of seeing. And you know, if you make peace, you know, as a loved one, as a visitor, you make peace with a person being sick, and you don't get into this serious mode, then what you're actually saying is that sickness and death are part of life. Just like getting married or seeing a child being born, like going to work. It's just part of things. And we shouldn't give it an importance which it really does not deserve. We amplify it as if it's something terrible and awful. So when you tell somebody, oh, my father just died, they say, I'm sorry. You're not sorry. You don't know my father. Why do you say, I'm sorry? We have these cultural ways of dealing with problems which are sometimes not appropriate. As a Buddhist monk, as someone who sees deeper, you can do different things at different purposes. If somebody really is in pain, I don't go in there and tell jokes. I once went to see a disciple who had a hysterectomy. If you've had that operation, you have a big scar in your stomach, at least they used to have, and it's very painful. And as soon as I came in, she said, Ajahn Brahm, please tell me no jokes. Because it hurts. So on that occasion, I was very serious and cool. But a lot of times, a bit of humor. And if you don't take it seriously, neither does the person dying. They loosen up, they get easy, they get more peaceful. And either they don't die at all, or they die well. But if you go up there, and you're, even like funeral services. You know, I've been to so many funeral services where you see these little children come in, maybe five or six, and they're full of life and they're playing. Sure that Grandpa has died, but we love Grandpa. Grandpa liked to see us play. And they go playing and laughing, and then they look at their father or their mother, and they see their mother so sad. I've seen the fear and the confusion in these little children. Say, what's going on? Why are you so hurting? Why have you got so much pain in you? It's a terrible lesson for children to learn. That's why that I try and allow the children to play at funerals. That's their nature. The best way they can pay respect to their grandpa is being happy. That's what their grandpa loved to see in their grandchildren. Play. That's why we want to try and stop some of the bad cultural ways of dealing with some of the problems in our life. Death is part of life. Even young people dying, that simile in my book, Falling Leaves. It's a very meaningful simile which has solved a lot of problems for people who have a child who dies or know someone very young dying. This monk told this story. He was staying in the north of Thailand, in a simple hut in the forest, bamboo and thatch. There's a storm at night, very violent storm in the jungle. The winds were so powerful that many branches came down and trees also came crashing down. And he was actually so scared for his life he couldn't sleep all night. Because if any tree or even heavy branch fell, it was only thatch, it would go straight through the roof. And if he was underneath, it would break his body, his bones, and maybe kill him. But he was lucky, good karma, that no tree actually fell through. He heard them crashing right next to his hut, but nothing actually broke through. He survived. And when he went out in the early morning, when the storm had gone, he saw all these big trees and branches had just missed his hut. He was really lucky to be alive. But what took his attention was the leaves which had been torn from the tree the night before. Because most of the leaves, as you would expect, were the old brown leaves, which had lived a full life on the tree. But amongst those old withered brown leaves were a few yellow leaves, even a few green leaves. And he noticed one or two, not many, young green leaves which could have only sprouted the day before. They also lay dead on the forest floor as a result of the storm. He looked back up on the trees. As you would expect, most of the leaves remaining alive on the tree were the green leaves. They had survived. But even though some young green leaves were on the floor, dead, still there were some curly old brown leaves still clinging on to the tree, still alive, even though young green leaves had fallen. And he got what we call the insight into the nature of life. When the winds of death go through our communities, they do usually take the old brown leaves. Our uncles and aunties, the old people. But they also take some middle-aged people, the yellow leaves. Some young people, the green leaves. They even take children as well. The leaves which have only sprouted the night before. When the wind blows, some of them also fall. This is the nature of storms, the nature of life and death. When he understood that, he understood nothing has gone wrong that children die or young people get cancer. This is the nature of our life. And we should be just grateful that the people have got so far, 6 years, 7 years of life. Thank you that you've reached so far. Now I let you go in peace. We never get angry or upset at nature. We understand it and work with it rather than against it. Working with the nature of life is the way of peace. Fighting against it, wanting only brown leaves to fall and no green leaves, is going against the nature of things and is a cause for anger and suffering. Look at all the people here today. I see many withered old brown leaves here. Still hanging on. When I know many young people have got cancer and are dying. Is there something gone wrong in life? This is the nature of life. So the Dhamma actually gives us a different vision of things. A vision according to nature, truth. And you know it's truth and nature if it brings peace to your heart. Now I understand. There's nothing gone wrong, nothing to blame. We make peace with it. Sorry, that was a long answer. I should actually answer some more questions. Okay, got one quick one here. I meditate, I feel relaxed to a point that I fall asleep. Is that meditation? If not, how do I overcome falling asleep? Once in the commentaries, the Buddha was going with his attendant, Ananda. As they were walking in the forest, they saw a monk sitting perfectly upright. Perfect posture. And the Buddha turned around to Ananda and said, I'm worried about that monk. 2 weeks later, that monk disrobed and got married. Further deeper in the forest, the Buddha saw another monk, nodding this way, nodding that way, half asleep. The Buddha turned around to Ananda and smiled. I'm not worried about him. 2 weeks later, he became enlightened with all the psychic powers. When I first read that story, that made no sense to me. How come the monk with the perfect posture, who was really disciplining himself, was going to lose the monkhood and become married? And with a monk who was the slack, lazy, sloppy monk, that he was about to become enlightened. I couldn't figure it out. Later on I understood that first monk was a control freak, forcing his body to be upright this way and forcing his mind. You never get any peace of mind through willpower, through force. You just get so tight, eventually you get frustrated, angry, depressed, give it up. He had never had any peace in his meditation. He looked perfect on the outside, but inside he was as tight as a ball. The monk who was nodding this way, he was letting go, he was becoming peaceful, he wasn't controlling things. It was only a matter of time when the cause of that sleepiness disappeared and he would be bright and alert, but peaceful enough to see the Dharma become enlightened. Sleepiness goes by itself after a while, but the worst thing is the restlessness. That is the one which we really want to overcome more than anything else. The tightness which makes you crazy. What is the origin of life? Why the Buddha did not tell us? Maybe one day humans can understand it. If the Buddha didn't tell you, why do you ask me? Good answer. But anyway, as they say, full step in where angels or the Buddha feels to tread. The origin of life. Okay, origin of life is craving. Whenever you desire to do things, you become alive, you create the world, and you create yourself, you create the body. So you can see the origin of life is actually craving. And why do we crave? It's just because of stupidity or delusion. We create because we think we're going to get some peace, some happiness, some joy. But the more you do, the more pain you get. You know, the longer you struggle, the more you feel that it's not working. I'm really working hard. I studied hard. I worked hard. Now I really put energy into my life and into my relationships. I even put energy into my meditation. I'm not getting peaceful. Sometimes a little light should go on in there. Maybe there's something wrong with what you're doing. You're struggling too hard. You are, say, trying to hold the water still, rather than letting it go, putting it down. You find that craving is the cause of suffering. It creates things, it creates worlds, it creates problems. And you let go of craving, sure enough you get peaceful. But as you get peaceful, you fade away and disappear. The ego fades away, your self disappears. When you disappear completely, that's called enlightenment. That's the origin of life and the end of life, the two ends, the meaning of life. Any problem there? Venerable cried twice at Vulture's Peak, the famous Chinese pilgrim, Xin Zheng of the Chinese legend Journey to the East, also wept uncontrollably. I personally had a funny sensation feeling there. Why? Why is the place of such significance, especially to those who are practicing the teachings of emptiness in the Prajnaparamita Sutra? Thank you. I don't plan to do these things. It just, I don't know, the energies of that place, maybe because it was a great place of meditation. If ever you go on these pilgrimages to India, you've got some very, very powerful places. And that's why basically it's because the devas are still around there. As far as deva lifespans are concerned, even the lowest devas, it's in deva spans, it's only about 4 days since the Buddha was there. They obviously still remember. It's just 4 days ago, the Buddha was sitting there getting enlightened and teaching in deva lifespans. So they're still around there in the numbers. You feel their energy. It's a powerful place. The last pilgrimage I led was this English lady from, she was Devon, I think. No, she was married to this Indian guy who was a main Buddhist. She was actually a Christian before, but I think she's a Buddhist now. She went with her husband on pilgrimage, and I gave her just a little bit of a talk beforehand of what to do, what to expect. And one of the things I said to all the people going on a pilgrimage, these are some very, very powerful places. In some of these places, you'll feel really big emotions coming up. You may even cry. And she came up to ask forgiveness after the trip. Because she told me when I said that, she said, "Oh, Ajahn Brahm, you're being stupid again. There's only ruins, you know, ancient places where the Buddha lived. There's no energy there. You know, I'm a scientist. You know, I'm rational." So she never believed a word of it. But first place we went to, the Mahabodhi Temple in Bodh Gaya. Now, many of you have been there. She walked into the temple and started weeping uncontrollably. She just couldn't stop herself. And she came up to me afterwards saying, "This is what happened. I'm sorry, you were right." And this, I tell this story because this was a Westerner who thought it was a completely hocus-pocus, a lot of bunkum, but it happened to her. She felt something so deep and so wonderful, and many people have done that. These are not even Buddhists go there. You know, Caucasians who have no cultural affinity for Buddhism. But wow, they just weep. And it's just the energy, the inspiration, something just gets way past your rational brain into your emotional heart. And this is beautiful. It's not weeping with sadness. It's just weeping with incredible power and inspiration. It's pity, pity sukha. So that happens to me in the Vulture's Peak. I love that place. You go there, wow, getting there again. You know, the other thing which makes me weep when I go to India, there's the most beautiful Buddha statue, which I think is the most beautiful in the world, which is in the museum at Sarnath, outside of Benares. The beautiful Dhammachaka Buddha. I'm sure you've seen it. I'm just looking at it. It's so common, with a big aura around the back. I always knew that was a very beautiful Buddha statue. So the first time I went to India, sort of I went looking for, I knew it was in the museum, but the museum in India was completely disorganized. There was no maps, no guide. You go in there, and you just left to yourself. So I went looking for it. All my disciples said, "You go and do what you want to do. I'm looking for this Buddha." And I went looking for it this way and that way. And I turned a corner and I saw it at the end of the corridor. And it just, energy, even now I can feel energy coming up. I started crying. Just bow, 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 many times you possibly can. It's the most beautiful Buddha statue I've ever seen. Second time I went there, I knew exactly where it was. And when we got in the museum, people were looking about all the other exhibits. I said, "No, we're going here first." And because I knew what to expect, I thought I was in control. No, it happened again. Went around the corner and saw it. Tears came. It's the most beautiful, inspiring, peaceful Buddha statue I've ever seen. It encapsulates this compassion, this softness, this beauty, this peace. Everything which I feel from a Buddha is right there in that carving. Third time I went there, I was expecting to cry. And when I went round the corner, they were doing renovations. It was covered with a cloth. They were painting and they didn't want any stuff to get over it. And the workman was there and I thought, oh no. And the workman looked at us. He couldn't understand English. He smiled and took the cloth off for us. Oh, so wonderful. It was like the disappointment made me cry even more because it was like disappointment and then relief, there it was again. You know, there's nothing wrong with emotions. I know I thought when I was young that you could actually, that an arahat, an enlightened being, had no emotions whatsoever. It was like a robot, like some zombie. And when I saw these enlightened beings in Thailand and they were just so full of happiness and joy. And now I understand these are tears of joy. And the emotion of happiness is actually the positive emotion which is supposed to develop amongst you when you develop the path. It's you let go of the negative emotions, the anger, the greed, the pride, the conceit. Those are the ones which goes. But the happy, the joy, the compassion grows stronger and stronger the closer you get to enlightenment. The Buddha was a very happy, beautiful person. So that's actually the goal. Not to be like some zombie who's got no emotions whatever. The negative emotions are what goes. Positive emotions stay. So I better carry on because I'm getting over time. Could you share more of the precept of no killing? Is ordering fish, etc. to be killed, considering as breaking this precept? Actually, that is, it's quite clear. If you tell someone to kill, that's like killing yourself if you order it. But if you don't know it's being killed for you, get some fish in a shop, then, of course, it's not considered to be killing. What never seen before animal did the late Ajahn Chah saw whilst having deep samadhi near the lake? Okay, that's called jhanas and enlightenment. It's a simile. The simile of the still forest pool. It's in my book. It's a great simile because that's when Ajahn Chah would actually sit very still when he was wandering around like I wandered around, find a nice lake so he could bathe, get some water for drinking. In the evening would set his mosquito net about 20 meters away from the lake side and sometimes watch the animals come out to play. But they'd only come out to play if he sat absolutely still. If he moved, the animals would know there was a human being there and would never come out. So he was so still, the animals would come and they would not realize a human being was watching them. So they could play naturally. He enjoyed them playing so much. I remember doing that once, watching the birds come to drink. And I noticed I put some water out in the jungle for these birds, and they were very orderly birds. They would actually line up in a queue. It's really cute, one after the other, all different species of birds. And one would go in first to drink and to wash. When they were finished, another one would come in, all in line. But then, as human nature, so bird nature, a bird jumped the queue. And all the other birds jumped up on him and beat him up. It's funny when you see nature in the wild. They're exactly like human beings, no different. But anyway, when he was really still, that's when the rare animals come out. And this simile was when you're very still in your mind, then these beautiful meditation experiences come. But if you move, they don't come. So you've got to be still, like, say, a nature photographer. Not moving so no one knows you're watching. And with that stillness, if you get really still, that's when these beautiful meditation states like jhanas come out. Amazing states of mind, which you don't realize exist. The amount of power and energy and bliss there is literally out of this world. But they only come out when you're absolutely still. If you say, "Wow, here it comes," they know you said something, and they rush into the bush. They never come out again for months. That's why meditation experiences, you have to be that still, just like you would be if there was waiting by a pool and wanting to watch the wild animals. It's a simile. It's one of the most beautiful ones. What is the first response from Venerable's mom when Venerable first announced his intention to enter into monkhood? To that great lady of Venerable, was she in grief? Simile for Venerable's sisters, thank you. I didn't have any sisters, so they didn't cry. My father never said anything either about me becoming a monk, because he had already died a few years earlier. But my mother, she was very happy I was becoming a monk, because I was a very responsible young man. I got a good degree, I'd always done the right thing, being very responsible and good and kind. She trusted me. She said, "I'm very happy you're a monk. The only thing I don't like is you're becoming a monk so far away. Even if I'd, you know, joined some corporation and they sent me to head office in Bangkok, she would have been similarly upset. Not because what I was doing, but simply the case, the mother likes to be close to their children." But you have to do that sometimes. You know, children go to university in England or Australia or America. Now, you let them go because you know it's good for them, but you don't like them going. You're separated from your kids. You just love them to be around. So I always make sure I couldn't call, there's no phone calls, but it was all right to my mother, and she was very, very happy. And eventually was really proud of me being a monk. Now, the first time I went home to visit her, Saturday morning was when she did her shopping for the week. And so I said, "Can I come with you? I can maybe help you carry your bags. I've come here to see you." So I went with her when we went shopping, where she goes every Saturday in this small, what they call the high street, it's not the big shopping malls, where she'd see all her friends. And first of all, I thought she'd be embarrassed by having a monk standing next to her in his funny clothes. I thought, you know, she would walk maybe, you know, a meter in front or a meter behind. I'm not with this strange-looking guy. But no, she walked right beside me. And then when we got to the place where we have the... Because there are very narrow roads in London, they have like railings to protect the pedestrians from the cars in the middle of the road. And usually on those railings, that's where you leave the prams and the tie up the dogs. And I thought that's where she'd leave me. While she goes into the shops. No, she didn't. She dragged me into the shop. And the first shop she went into, where she goes regularly every week, she said to the shopkeeper, "This is my son, the Buddhist monk." I realized from that my mother was proud of me. She wasn't at all embarrassed. And that was such a wonderful feeling. And I understand now that that's how mothers feel. Even if your son or your daughter's a bank robber, you say, "He's the best bank robber in the whole of Malaysia." A mother's love for their children is something else. And I think you women will understand that. But obviously she was very proud that I wasn't a bank robber, I was a very good monk. How does one have a relationship with a person who is verbally abusive and egotistical? Even in public in front of kids, not improved despite life-threatening experiences, throat cancer and stroke, psychologically manipulative. Please do not say these. You should have said that first of all. Are not financially responsible, thank you very much, with repeated sexual misconduct as well. Gee, why did you choose that person in the first place? Please choose your relationships well. So, you know, check them out first of all. Don't just marry someone because they've got lots of money or because they look really hot. You know, because that doesn't last very long. You're marrying a person, not a body. You're not marrying a bank account. So when you realize what you're marrying, can you choose somebody who is a good character? However, if you have got that person as a partner and you really want to try working it out, there are ways of training a husband or a wife. I didn't actually say a husband. There are ways of training them, but it takes a lot of effort. And sometimes you have to find out why are they sort of in such a bad mood. One of the best ways is take them to the Buddhist Gem Fellowship. Teach them some meditation. We'll sort them out. But that's a big question, but actually a bit of meditation does really help them. Martial arts involves aggression and meditation seems to involve loving kindness. Can the two coexist? Sometimes practicing martial arts seems to involve a mindset that is contrary to harmlessness. Thank you very much, Ajahn Brahm. Again, I never did martial arts, so I don't know too much about it, but I do know that people start martial arts with aggression, but eventually as you go to the higher stages it's more sort of non-violent and more like a mental and physical training. You're not meant to harm anyone. If you have to harm someone, that shows you're not really skillful enough. I know in Thailand, the military in Thailand used to have, this is 200-300 years ago, that they used to meet their adversaries in battle and they used to make the most noise they could, and the army which made the most noise would win and the other one would just concede. They never used to actually go into battle. It was all like show and huff and puff. And if you had to go into battle, the general was considered to be a failure because they wanted to have a bit of non-violence. However, that stopped these days. But if you do have aggression, I don't think you can really go too far in martial arts. I think in the real martial arts. I don't know, see what martial arts you're doing, see what type of teacher you have. And maybe you don't want to do it. Maybe you can just go to the gym and become fit and come here to train the mind. So it's up to you. How do you live with people that's full of anger? This is a person with a heart of gold, but yet a hot temper person that always overly dominates others. If they've got a heart of gold, please tell them what a beautiful heart of gold they have. And let them value their heart of gold so much they never want to express the other part of them of anger and domination. Because they really have got a beautiful heart inside. They've got a seed which can grow. And if that seed is watered and grows enough, then it will dominate their other part of the character, the anger, and they will sort of just let go. They have to be less controlling. They say domination and anger, they always go together. The hot temper becomes when you get frustrated, when you try and control things, but it doesn't work out anymore. And you get frustrated and angry. So that's where we have to just let things go. Is it true that the only son of the second richest man in Malaysia and landowner of the Twin Towers and the owner of Astro and Maxis renounced under Venerable's great teacher, the late Ajahn Chah? Is it okay for us to know the reasons for the multi-billionaire in waiting to decide so? And if so, what is all the reasons? Thank you. Yeah, that's true. And I know him very well. He's a great fan. He spent a year at my monastery over in Perth and still met him a couple of weeks ago. And he said he never got much meaning in life from wealth. He's a very skillful person. And one of the things he's got, knows many languages. He went over to Russia and quickly learnt Russian and worked for the BBC in Russia for a while. And one of the things he can do, a perfect imitation of me. And all the other senior monks, he's got this ability to imitate people's voice and mannerisms. So the next time if you see him, ask him, can you impersonate Ajahn Brahm? And it's amazing, he's just got this ability that if you close your eyes, you think that's Ajahn Brahm speaking. So that's one of the abilities he's got. And so he plays around that with the lesser monks, the smaller monks, but he refuses to do it with me. I said, come and impersonate me, and he refuses to do so. I thought it would be very funny to hear what I sound like. But he did that because he gets much more happiness and peace being a Buddhist monk, much more meaning in life. And this is great because it's people who have the opportunity for wealth. You know, if he's a son of a multi-billionaire, you know, basically that many women would look at him and say, wow, he's a catch. Because, you know, he's young, he's good looking, and he's very skilled, you know, what degrees he's got, and very wealthy. Wow, yeah, he must, yeah, we want him. So he could have almost any girl he wanted. He didn't have to work. He could go wherever he wants. Isn't it wonderful that there's a person who's not just renounced a small amount, but renounced a lot, just like the Buddha renounced, you know, a kingship. And those are the people who just really make you think. Why did he do that? He didn't do that through force. He's been a monk for about 11 years now, I think. He could leave at any time, but he doesn't want to. Because he gets more peace and happiness from living a simple life of meditation and service to others than from anything else. He has a choice, and he chose simplicity more than wealth. That's why it's inspiring. I didn't have wealth, but I had a good career in front of me, you know, a good degree, good life. But no, I prefer being a monk as well. There's another fellow who lives up in Thailand still. About 30 years ago, his parents, very wealthy, came to Thailand with a blank check for $1 million US. They would give it to their son if you would disrobe. No questions asked, just $1 million US. And that was a time when $1 million was worth something. You know, 30 years ago. I don't know what inflation is. But that, how much would that be worth now? Any economists here, 1 million these days? Was it 30 million or 20 million? It's a lot of money. And it was just, no questions asked, if you leave the robes now, you can have 1 million. No. And still a monk today. There's a few people like that, which actually shows that this being a monk renouncing, there must be something in this when it's worth more than a million. So, peace of mind is worth more than all the money in the world. Peace is priceless, which is why if you really understand the peace and happiness of deep meditation, of making peace with whatever you have to do in life, you find that no amount of money would ever make you leave. We make money to find peace. We don't give up peace to have money. And there we go. What a wonderful place to end this Dharma enrichment camp. Not enrichment, but giving up your worldly riches to have Dharma riches. You got a question?
Clarification. What would you say to a person who is commonly ill? Like the Tibetan nun wanted to see what you share with
I told her all my latest jokes. Because that's what she wanted. She was dealing with her pain and difficulty. But what she really craved was to be related to as a person rather than somebody dying. And that really meant something to me. That was her choice. Please tell me the jokes. You're the only one who actually doesn't talk to my sickness, but talks to me. There's something more than my sickness. I am a person who is dying, not dying, and the person has disappeared. It's always really important. That's why if you see someone disabled, there's a person inside that autistic being. In that Down syndrome child, you can see just the inability to communicate, but underneath that there's a person, a being in there. Please, please recognize and talk to the person. Don't talk to the sickness. Okay, I think that's enough. Otherwise I get in trouble and you'll get in trouble for going over time. Because if you go over time, it's 5 o'clock. Do we have to actually pay extra money?